It's 10:06. Hunter S. Thompson, the inventor and father of gonzo journalism. He would have been 74 last week. He died in 2005, but his legacy lives on in the things he wrote and the stories that people still tell about him. Kathleen Dunn producer Chrissy Pease is a huge Hunter S. Thompson fan. She thought it would be a good idea for us to take a look at his life and work, and I agreed with her, so here we are. Good morning, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest this hour is William McKean, professor and chair of the journalism department at Boston University, and author of Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson. Good morning, professor, and welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
What would you say would be the most common misconception about Hunter S. Thompson?
I think people who read his work think that he really was that character he called in his stories either Raoul Duke or Hunter S. Thompson, and that he wasn't really that wild and crazy character. That was kind of an enhanced version of reality, and that I think people confuse the image too much with the man, and I think they always expected him to kind of be on the edge of reality and intense and, you know, barking and being a mad dog, when actually he was sort of a Southern gentleman type who had created this character that was overshadowing the real man.
Did that cause a problem for him personally, the conflict between the public persona and the person that he really was?
I don't know that it caused a problem for him personally. I think his friends knew the story, and they got it. But I do believe that the public expected him to be a certain way, and so he didn't want to disappoint. I think that's part of his sort of Southern gentlemanly manners, is he wants to be nice to people and wants to give them what they want. So I had an experience with him once, and a lot of his friends told me the same thing, in that I was hosting him at a university, and we had a very pleasant chat backstage. We had something to eat, had a couple of drinks, and we're just having a normal conversation. He said, "Well, no, tell me about your family. Where are you from?" And just a nice regular guy, and then the moment we walked on stage, his whole body language changed, and he began to walk different, and he began to act different, and it's that he had, that's when I really got it, because that was back in the 1970s, and I was one of those people that had kind of confused the caricature with the real man, and then I saw, oh, that's all an act. So I think that's what people expected of him, and I think it became kind of a trap for him, because it was the crazed character. Douglas Brinkley calls it the Hunter figure. A lot of people might call it Raoul Duke, because that was the alter ego that he portrayed in his stories. You know, that was a great literary invention. It was a great way to tell a story, but it was like, after a while, that's all people wanted from him. And I think he felt that he didn't use all of the potential he had as a writer, which I think was considerable, and he kind of slipped into self-parody a lot in the last 20, 25 years of his life.
Mm-hmm. Where did he come from? How did he end up getting into journalism?
Well, that's kind of interesting. He's from Louisville, Kentucky, which, if you know the place, is actually pronounced Louisville, and it's kind of a one-stop center for vice, in the sense that, you know, a lot of tobacco companies are from around there. I think there's some astonishing percentage that I have in my book of 85% of the world's bourbon comes from within 35 miles of his home, and apparently that's where most of it is also consumed. So from the time he was 12 or 13, he was drinking and smoking heavily, and yet he learned to accommodate this in his diet. I mean, that stuff never really messed him up. There's a funny story that Senator George McGovern liked to tell about when he and his wife Eleanor went out to dinner with Hunter Thompson, and the waitress came up, and Hunter said, "I want 4 Heineken and 4 margaritas," and she starts to walk away, and he says, "Well, aren't you going to ask what they want?" And he was just a guy with tremendous appetite, and it got him into a lot of trouble. Well, he never really finished high school. He was, or at least he didn't go through the graduation, because he had committed a crime and was in jail, and then when he left, he was urged to join the military. And that's when he started his serious writing career. He became he found out that if he was the editor of the Air Force Base newspaper, that he would have as much freedom as you could possibly have in the military. And that's when he became pretty serious about this gift he had.
So when he got out of the service, what did he do to pursue that?
Well, he was asked to leave the service, although it wasn't a dishonorable discharge. I don't know how they managed to work that, but he left the service, and I think his first job was at a newspaper in Pennsylvania. He vandalized the car of one of his colleagues, and so he left that job, and then he went to a job at a newspaper in upstate New York, and he killed a vending machine in the break room, and so they asked him to leave that job. And that's really the end of the kind of career that you would put on a resume. I think from that point on, you'd have to say that he was a freelance and lived as a freelance writer for 50 years or so, which is a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, most freelance writers don't eat regular meals. I mean,
right.
they have a pretty tough time keeping going.
Yeah, he really had to scrape around for several years until the general public sort of took notice of him. It was probably from the time he got out in the military about 1957 until 1967 there, so probably a full decade, until he began to have anything that was even remotely considered a success. If it weren't for his wife, and they were domestic partners before then, before their marriage, she worked as a motel maid. She was a caretaker at an estate. I mean, she was the one that kind of kept the operation going. And for many years, his only contribution to the family income was what he got from donating blood, because he wasn't getting any money from writing.
Jeez. Well, that probably speaks to a lot of writers out there. Did he actually coin the term gonzo journalism? And if not, who did?
Well, it's interesting. The guy that coined that term was a friend of his who worked here at the Boston Globe, and it was in response to an article that Hunter wrote in 1970 that he thought was going to be the end of his career, because he had to write this article. He was under a horrible deadline. It was about the Kentucky Derby, and he wrote, you know, a fairly coherent beginning to of the story, but they were on him for the copy, and so finally he gave them the yellow legal pad he'd been keeping notes on. And his notes were pretty detailed, but still they were notes. And he handed them that and said, "There it is," and he left. And he flew back home to to Colorado, where he lived, and he thought, well, that's it. That's the end of his career. I'll never be asked to work in journalism again. And then as soon as it appeared in the magazine, and this is in 1970, as soon as it appeared in the magazine, people were writing him notes and letters and calling him and saying, "This is the next step in the evolution of journalism. You have done something magnificent here." Well, one of his friends, who was a guy named Bill Cardozo at the Boston Globe, wrote him a note and said, "Man, that was pure gonzo." And that's where that came from. At least that's one of the derivations of it. And it's apparently local slang here in Boston for the last man standing after a night of drinking. And yet I also found out that there was this old song he used to listen to in New Orleans radio when he was in the military. He was stationed in the Florida Panhandle. It was a loopy little instrumental by James Booker called Gonzo. So maybe those two things connected in his head, but he took on the name Gonzo Journalism.
What does it really mean?
Well, we talk about this a lot, and I get interviewed a lot about what gonzo means and who's doing gonzo today, and I think the really safe definition of gonzo journalism is it's whatever Hunter Thompson wrote. And therefore, I don't know that I think anyone that tries to do gonzo is going to, today, I think anyone who tries to do gonzo is sort of going to fail, because it's going to be an imitation. It's not going to be honest. It's not going to be out of their DNA as gonzo was out of his. But I also think one of the characteristics of it is that what he really wrote was journalism about journalism, in that no matter what he wrote, it was always about the struggle of this character, like we called him, the Hunter figure or the Raoul Duke character. Whatever he wrote is always about the struggle of this character to write a story. And what was, I think, intriguing about that is that it brought readers in to the part that journalists normally keep out of stories, and that is how they got this information. And see, he would put it all in. He would say, I got a phone call from somebody, and this guy's a weasel, but I went ahead and talked to him, and so on and so forth. And so he would take the readers through the process. But it was always about the struggle to write a story. And so, in a sense, no matter what he started off writing about, it always ended up being about himself. And, again, that was a great device, a great literary technique for him. And it worked, and I think he created several very fine articles and at least two or three really fine books. But it also became a trap, because I don't think people would accept anything else from him except that style.
So in Hollywood terms, he got typecast.
He did, yeah. It's an excellent way of putting it.
Leonard Nimoy always has to play Spock.
That's right. And so his equivalent of the pointy ears, Hunter's equivalent, was I gotta be a mad dog. I gotta be on the edge. I gotta be, always foaming at the mouth. I gotta be crazy. I gotta be absolutely insane. I have to be insulting people left and right. And that wasn't really what the guy was like. And that I think he had an enormous talent that I don't think he really used very well. When he was good, he was very, very good, sort of like the poem about the little girl with the curl. But his first wife said to me when I was doing my book, he had the problem with Hunter near the end of his life was he knew that he'd blown it. And that's why he couldn't live with himself anymore. He knew how good he could have been, but he wasn't nearly there because he had fallen into this trap and by his own admission, become kind of a lazy hillbilly and just continued on feeding that caricature, that other Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Here's the number to call if you would like to ask a question about Hunter S. Thompson, or maybe share a comment about how maybe you read his books, you were affected in some way by a story that he wrote. You may have a personal recollection. Maybe you met Hunter S. Thompson. You want to share that. Here's how you get in touch with us. It's a different number than the one we used last hour. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Leave a comment there, and we'll share it on the radio. We're talking about the life and times, the work of Hunter S. Thompson. He would have been 74 years old last week. And so we thought it might be an appropriate time to take a look back at what he did accomplish and the problems that he had and so forth. My guest is William McKean, professor and chair of the journalism department at Boston University. He's the author of Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation here about Hunter Thompson. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 20 minutes after 10 o'clock, here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. On At Issue with Ben Marins from 4 to 5, you'll have two different candidates talking about recalls. After 4, it'll be State Senator Alberta Darling of River Hills. And then after 4:30, Sandy Pash, Democrat from Whitefish Bay, will be in with Ben. So an hour of that on At Issue at 4 o'clock today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the life of Hunter S. Thompson, who committed suicide in 2005. But his legacy lives on. A lot of people remember his work and are still affected by it. A number of biographies have been written about Thompson. We have the author of one of them with us, William McKean, professor and chair of the journalism department at Boston University. He is the author of Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson. And we, as soon as I gave the phone numbers, Professor, the phones absolutely just kind of blew up. So we're collecting all these phone calls and getting them ready to go on the air. But before we do that, I wanted to, because we talked about, the nature of the kind of journalism that that Thompson became known for, perhaps it would be a great time then to talk about the Hell's Angels and how he got connected with them and what came out of that association. He spent a year with the Angels.
Right, and the thing is, there were all these stories in the press in the mid-1960s about these savages in the Hells Angels who would go around and get innocent people at bars and yank their teeth out with pliers and then wear them on a chain on their belt and all this kind of stuff. Well, most of these stories that were in the mainstream magazines and newspapers were written by people who'd never even laid eyes on a Hells Angel. And so Hunter was approached by the editor of the Nation magazine to do a piece on the Angels. And he went to where he knew they hung out and introduced himself. And they were just startled by that because they'd never actually seen a journalist. And he said, you know, I've heard all these stories about you. Are any of them true? And they really admired the fact that he was there to talk to them and he trusted them. And even though he wrote an article about them that was called Losers and Outsiders, they ended up liking the guy, even though he typed them as Losers and Outsiders. And within about a week of that being published, Hunter's mailbox was filled with offers to write books. And he took the one that offered cash immediately without having to do any further work of writing a prospectus or any of that business of doing a book proposal. And then he did spend a year with them. But this came in that the publishers would have called him, but his phone had been disconnected for non-payment. This came in the period when his only income was from giving blood. He only got $100, I believe, for writing that article on the Angels, even though he spent 2 months of his life researching it. So he rode with the Angels, and then something happened at the end of his time with the Angels, and that gave everyone the opening when they were reviewing his book or interviewing about the book. He claims he was stomped by the Angels. The Angels believe he provoked them into kicking him because it would give him a nice ending for the book. So there's still a controversy these many years later about what actually happened, but it was a great opening question for any interviewer, like, what exactly was it like to get stomped by the Hells Angels? And it kind of put him on the map as, that lunatic reporter that rode around with the motorcycle gang. So that was the thing that kind of brought him to the fore. Looking at it now, Hells Angels is probably the most conventional thing he ever wrote, because although he's obviously in the book and he's riding with the Angels and he was riding behind them in a Rambler. He wasn't on a motorcycle. But anyway, he could have been in the book a lot, and what's remarkable is his restraint. He really holds himself back, and he's trying to do a kind of a more conventional piece of journalism, and he hadn't really discovered his inner Gonzo yet.
Okay. All right, we had an email. We were talking earlier about Hunter S. Thompson as being really he was the true purveyor of Gonzo journalism, and it's about him, and it would be pretty tough for anyone to try to claim that mantle today without being an imitator. But we did have an email with a question. How about Sacha Baron Cohen? Do you think he is modern-day Gonzo?
Well, I've never heard anyone use him in this context, but the problem with that is that I think it's a disservice to the other writers or artists. It's like all those people that were originally the new Bob Dylan, who later had enough talent to become the present John Prine, the present Bruce Springsteen, and all of that. And I think Sacha Baron Cohen, that's an interesting name to bring up. I mean, I guess if there's Gonzo filmmaking, maybe that's what he was doing, but you know, to me, Gonzo is just this one guy and maybe Ralph Steadman, the artist that worked with him. And it's a very special kind of area. And I kind of, in this world where there's so many writers and artists and actors and musicians and so forth struggling to find their style, I hate to really lump them with someone else's style. And I tell you this because you know, my day job is as a professor, of course, and I teach a lot of kids in writing classes, and they all want to write like Hunter Thompson. They say, "Can I do a Gonzo piece? Can I? And I say, "Yeah, sure, go ahead." And they try it, and they come to me, and they say, this is awful. This is just a rotten failure. You know, what went wrong? And I say, "Well, look, there's only one person that can write like that, and he's dead. But there's only one person that can write like you." And so, in a way, Hunter's been very helpful to me and probably a lot of other teachers of writing by showing that, you know, you have this powerful style within you. You just have to release it. And Hunter was always a great, vivid writer when he was writing to his friends, when he's published three books of his correspondence. And they're just terrific. But then you read the journalism he was writing at the time, and it was kind of conventional. Well, once he knocked down all those barriers and got to that true voice of his that showed in his letters to his friends, well, then he was on his way. And so that's what I kind of try to tell students, is that you have a writing style. You just don't, you can't recognize it yet, but it's there. And it's kind of like when you're a parent, and I've had a lot of children, you know, when you look at the baby's face, it's a baby. But when that kid is now 25 or so, you look back at the baby's face, you see the adult face was there all along. You just didn't see it. So that's kind of the example I give with the writing style and how it's okay to imitate Gonzo one time just to see that it's an impossible thing to do, but then it will help you as you kind of drift toward finding your own style as a writer.
The Rolling Stones, Matt Taibbi often gets compared to Hunter Thompson and P.J. O'Rourke, who both previously occupied the Rolling Stone National Affairs Desk. He doesn't like that comparison. What do you think of it?
You know, I like him an awful lot, and I know that this is a thing that's going to kind of dog him for a few years, but I think he's got enough talent that he's going to overcome it, and pretty soon, you know, I don't think Hunter's going to go away. I still think your typical 18-year-old college student has a copy of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in the back pocket. But I do think that that Matt is developing his own audience, and I think he's very talented, and I do think it's a disservice to him to just classify him as the new Hunter or a Gonzo journalist or something like that.
Yeah, we always want to slap labels on people, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, it's, and you know, having worked in journalism, it's an easy thing to do, and you know, in a way, we're trying to help people. We're trying to say, if you like Hunter Thompson, you might like this guy. Or, you know, if you like Bob Dylan, then listen to John Prine. But, you know, after a while you realize, and I use John Prine as an example because I remember him being slapped at that new Dylan tag about 1970. Wow, you know, what a career he had. What a brilliant writer he was. I wouldn't confuse him with Bob Dylan at all anymore. But, you know, that may have been the thing that got me to listen to him in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a lot of people on the line that want to ask questions, so I'm going to get out of the way here, and we'll go to the phones, and we'll hear from Ben in Eau Claire first. Good morning, okay. Ben. Thanks for holding.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I just had a question. Before his untimely death, I guess, he was working on a piece about 9/11, and there was a radio broadcast that I had heard. Where he was interviewed and said that he had feared for his life because of what he was writing. I'm just wondering what your thoughts or opinions are on that, or if you know anything about that. I haven't heard anything about the book being published after the fact, or if he ever completed it. I'm just curious. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that same recording, and one thing to keep in mind is that Hunter Thompson was an apocalyptic character. The apocalypse was around every corner. And so he may have just been a little over the top talking about fearing for his life. But I think there's so much of Hunter's work that hasn't been published yet that will be published that we'll probably see that someday, or at least see the notes for it. His literary executor just says, I think there's something like 80 crates worth of manuscript stuff that hasn't been published. So he's got another novel or two, a collection of short stories, lots of journalism. In between Hell's Angels and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, he wrote another book that has not been published that, who knows, may be published soon. There's a lot of stuff out there. So I probably can't comment on what he was writing about 9/11 because I haven't seen it. I do think that when a lot of people say, oh, man, after the 70s, he never wrote anything good again, I think that's a real disservice to him, because he did write a couple of things that, you know, were not up to his standard, but he did write a couple of really beautiful things, and one is his absolutely irreverent, nasty, hideous obituary for Richard Nixon, which he wrote in the 90s, obviously, when President Nixon died, and also the piece he wrote the morning of 9/11, which appeared on the ESPN website, which is where he had a, a weekly column. So I think he had it all the way up to the end when he felt like using it.
When we had an email from Charlie from Superior, when Hunter S. Thompson died in 2005, was his wife still alive at that time? He had planned on committing suicide in 2005 for a long time, and Charlie's wondering if his wife was still alive, what did she have to say about his death?
His first wife, Sandy, had divorced Hunter I think they separated in 1979. I think the divorce was not final until 1981. And he had a number of different companions over the years, but he had gotten married in 2004, I believe, maybe in 2003. I don't have my book handy. But anyway, fairly near the end, he married a young woman, Anita Thompson. And she was actually on the phone with him when he committed suicide. They had had an argument the night before. The next day, she got up and went to the health club to work out. She called home. They were on the phone. And Hunter's grown son, Juan, and his wife, and Hunter's grandson were elsewhere in the house when he committed suicide.
Oh, my.
Yeah. That's
all right.
Difficult thing to deal with.
Mm-hmm. We'll go next to Oshkosh and hear from Tyler.
Oh, hi. I just have a quick comment. I'd like to bring up Oscar Zeta Acosta, who some people might know as Dr. Gonzo from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He was the Chicano lawyer. And anyone out there who really loves Hunter Thompson should totally read Oscar Acosta's autobiography of A Brown Buffalo or Revolt of the Cockroach People. They're both just absolutely brilliant. And if anything, he was as much of a character as Hunter Thompson himself. So thanks a lot. Great show.
You know, if I may, I'm glad you brought that up, because Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was sort of loosely based on a true story where Hunter was trying to interview Oscar Acosta for a very serious article about the murder of a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And none of the people around Oscar would let Hunter near him because, you know, Hunter was the gringo journalist. Well, Oscar and Hunter went back a few years, so Hunter got this assignment to go cover a motorcycle race in Las Vegas. And took Oscar along, and this was going to be an all-expenses-paid trip. So they went there, and essentially what happened became the meat of the book Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Well, thank God, Hunter was sort of addicted to recording everything in his life. If you look in his file boxes, he has pictures of the rooms in which he lived, just empty rooms, but he documented everything. And so he had tape recordings of all of his time in Las Vegas with Oscar, and now they're commercially available. There's a box set called Gonzo. It was kind of tied into the Alex Gibney film of about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. Or you could get it at your local library, and it's just fascinating to hear these two guys going around having a conversation in the front of a rented car that, you know, now lives as literature. It's been, you know, almost 40 years since that book came out. And one of the things that held up publication, it appeared in Rolling Stone magazine in 1971, didn't appear as a book until 72. One of the things that held up publication was that Oscar Acosta was saying to Hunter, wait, that's my intellectual property. You're reporting what I said, and it's in your book. Either we're co-authors, or I'm not going to give you permission. And finally, he backed down. But, that's the way. The way that the character Dr. Gonzo speaks in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, that's Oscar Acosta, who disappeared about 1974 and 1975. They're never sure what happened to him. But he was another very important creative partner for Hunter Thompson.
Tyler, thanks thanks for the call. Let's go next to Daryl in Exonia. Daryl, good morning.
Hi, I was going to say that movie Where the Buffalo Roam with Bill Murray.
Yes.
And my favorite quote from the movie is when he gets up in front of the audience and he says, well, I don't want to advocate drugs and alcohol, but they've always worked for me. I always thought that was kind of funny. And then in the movie, they kind of ask, was Laszlo real? And I was wondering, is Laszlo, was his lawyer real? Peter Boyle played him?
Yeah, the character, the movie was based on an article that Hunter wrote in 1977 It was called The Banshee Screams for Buffalo Meat. And he knew that Acosta hadn't been seen for a couple of years. So his purpose in writing that article, and it was for the 10th anniversary issue of Rolling Stone, his purpose in writing the article was to write something so nasty and so libelous about Oscar Acosta that it would make him surface. And so he published it and then didn't hear from Oscar, and he said that's when he knew he was dead. But although that was his purpose, to be nasty and so forth, ends up being a pretty affectionate portrait of this friend. Well, when they made the film, there was a lot of objection to Peter Boyle playing a Hispanic character because he's not Hispanic. And so they changed him to Bulgarian or whatever. And it's really unfortunate because, of course, Peter Boyle was an excellent actor. I think that as great as Johnny Depp was playing Hunter Thompson in the movie of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I think the best performance was Bill Murray as Hunter Thompson. But the movie is just, it's so, where the Buffalo Roam is so hard to watch because it's just kind of an excruciatingly bad movie with two great performances trapped inside. But yes, that character, Laszlo, in the movie is Oscar Acosta, supposedly.
Daryl, thanks for that call. Let's see. Let's take one more call before we go to break. We'll go to Mineral Point next. JR, you're on. Go ahead. Hello, JR, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, JR. Yeah, go ahead, you're on.
I grew up as a young man reading Doonesbury, and I know that's an image that he sort of came to dread, and as you said, that he fell into that stereotype and was sort of a lodestone image of this person, and Doonesbury probably, obviously didn't help that. But I wanted to say also you said some people have said, quite a few people said he hadn't written anything past the 70s, and The Generation of Swine, I thought that was a good collection. I purchased that when it came out. But when you said that, the first book, Hell's Angels, I was interested. You said when he said he thought he had burned out, going back to that, where he thought maybe, well, not burned out, where he thought he didn't really make it as a journalist. Do you think that, don't you think that that was actually could have, that's I thought a very good book. I read that years later, and I thought that there was, for a first book, and that he could have gone on if he, wouldn't have fallen into the Gonzo thing. But then there's great, great books with Fear and Loathing and the Shark Hunt, Greg Shark Hunt. But that's basically, I was curious about the Hell's Angels book. And
okay. Thanks, Jerry. Your cell is kind of bad there.
What you're trying to do is to get me to say something really good about Hell's Angels, which is not hard to do. I've begun teaching that book rather than Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas because I think the style of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is just so great and so distinctive that it kind of overshadows him as a reporter. And also, everyone's read it. All the kids have already read it, but they haven't read Hell's Angels, and I think they really appreciate the depth of that book and the great reporting in it, and how good he is when he set his mind to it as a somewhat conventional journalist. The thing about the ending of the book was that he already had a pretty good ending, a nice piece called Midnight on the Pacific Coast Highway, but he went back to see the Angels one more time. And when I interviewed Sonny Barger, who was the maximum leader of the Angels then, he really believes that Hunter provoked a fight just so he could write about it at the end of the book to give himself a kind of a more charged ending. So that's something that obviously I would like to have asked Hunter, but my seance hasn't worked.
What did he think about the Doonesbury strip?
He hated it with every sinew of his being. He really felt that character Uncle Duke typed him, and he didn't know Gary Trudeau. He didn't know why Gary Trudeau picked him, but it made him, the Doonesbury Strip made him miserable, and he did not find it funny at all. In fact, in his correspondence, you'll find lots of letters where he writes to G.B. Trudeau and says, "Stop, I'm going to set you on fire. I hate you." And, you know, he was serious.
Hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want us to talk about, well, I want to start with why Thompson hated Richard Nixon. And then we'll talk about the you brought up Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail. I want to talk about that and how and the journalism that Thompson practiced on the campaign trail in those really exciting years there in the early 70s for political journalism. We also have some more callers who want to join us. There's a line available for you if you call right now, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the life and work of Hunter S. Thompson. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Hey, tomorrow at this hour, we'll be talking with Brian Cox, Royal Society University Research Fellow in Particle Physics Group at the University of Manchester. He's written a new book that goes along with a BBC television series, Wonders of the Universe. That's tomorrow morning after 10 o'clock. This hour, we're talking about the life and work of Hunter S. Thompson. And my guest is William McKean, professor and chair of the journalism department at Boston University and author of Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson. One of the things, professor, that... one of the salient features of Hunter S. Thompson's career as a journalist was his intense dislike of Richard Nixon. Where did that come from?
You know, I don't know where it started, but my feeling is that Nixon was Hunter Thompson's muse, in that he did his best work when he was filled with rage for President Nixon. And he did, almost immediately after President Nixon's resignation, Hunter went into a fairly long dry period of at least 5 years where he could only write one article a year or so. He was had been kind of on a frenetic pace all of his life, but he just came to a stop because I think he felt that the thing that made him get up every morning was to know that he could go to his typewriter, an IBM Selectric 2, by the way, and pound away at those keys and fill... his stories with all the hate and rage he had for Nixon. They only met once. It was a kind of a famous encounter during the 1968 primary season when Nixon was campaigning in New Hampshire, and he wanted to talk pro football with someone, and Hunter was the only reporter who knew much about football. So they got in the car and talked for 45 minutes or an hour on the way to an airport on the condition that they speak about nothing but football. So anyway, he said that, you know, he had some admiration for him because he's a great football junkie, but there was just something about Nixon about how he said he represented the dark side, the dark underbelly of the American dream, and I really can't repeat some of the more foul things he said about the president, but the obituary he wrote was left no doubt how Hunter felt, where he said that what we really need to do to mark this occasion is to dump his casket into a sewage canal that drains into the ocean. And, you know, I don't know that anyone could have said it better.
But, well, let's talk about some of the stories that came up on when he was covering that campaign. You had that 1972 presidential campaign had a lot of really interesting characters. You had... you had Humphrey still trying to make it happen. Edmund Muskie, obviously the eventual Democratic nominee George McGovern, going up against the Nixon juggernaut.
Well, it was a great. I covered that campaign too as a young reporter, and I remember in our newsroom, which is I was in Bloomington, Indiana, sort of a Big Ten college town. You know, there's a lot of political activity, there's a lot of excitement. But all of us on the newspaper just adored what Hunter Thompson was writing in Rolling Stone every 2 weeks about the campaign. And that was, I think, the year that really hooked me on American politics. I mean, I'd been a kid until then. I obviously paid attention to politics, but I just love the machinery of it all. And I think, again, because of Hunter's style, wasn't really just writing about a candidate. It's writing about Hunter Thompson trying to write about a candidate, or Hunter Thompson trying to write about something else, is that it really took readers into the tent and showed them how this all worked. And it really explained the political process, I think, better than anything I'd read to that time. Frank Mankiewicz was the man running the George McGovern campaign, and he's quoted many times saying that Hunter's account of that campaign was the most accurate but the least factual. And I'm not quite sure what that means, but it's just that I think Hunter really conveyed the energy of that campaign and the process of selecting a president better than anyone else ever has. Now, maybe he got a few things wrong here and there that Theodore H. White might have gotten right, but still, I reread that book every now and then, and Hunter's son held a seminar at the Aspen Institute 3 or 4 years ago dedicated to just that book, and all the heavyweights were there. You know, Carl Bernstein came, and Walter Isaacson, and a lot of other major figures in American journalism and politics, because there's so much respect for that book.
We have an email from Sandra in Madison who writes, I just don't get why Thompson killed himself. I know he had a bad car accident before his death and that he wasn't really recovering, but I didn't think car accidents could trigger suicide. But Thompson had always said all along he planned to kill himself, hadn't he?
You know, looking back, you could see that he'd written suicide notes all of his life. And, in fact, the author picture on the back of The Great Shark Hunt was a drawing of him with a gun at his head. And the introduction of that book was sort of saying, you know, I think I should jump out this window in the publisher's office and hit that fountain down there. And if I don't do it, I'll always regret that I didn't. So it's like there were always these signs. And, you know, when I got the call the night that he killed himself to report, and I said, I bet he was terminally ill. Well, I think in a way he was, and there's an element of serendipity that happened to me when I was writing this book. I had an accident, and I was in a wheelchair for about 6 months. Well, I knew I was going to walk again. Well, he was about to turn 70, and, you know, for him, it didn't look so good. He was in a wheelchair. He had, you know, a lot of other health problems. He was, you know, having some trouble with, you know, basic elimination. And that's just not the way you think of Hunter Thompson. His son said, you know, can you see Hunter Thompson in a hospital bed hooked up to some tubes? That's just not him. And so, again, I think it came down to image. If people saw Hunter Thompson in a wheelchair, he would have been mortified. And so I think he thought, I need to take myself out before this gets any worse. The problem I always had with that is, well, aren't there other ways to do this? You know, are you going to do it while you're on the phone with your wife, or are you going to do it with your son and your grandson in the next room? That's the part of it that troubled me. I guess no one should have really been surprised that he took himself out. But still, it's the way that he did it. It's, to me, the ultimate act of selfishness.
Well, I read one writer's account of this. The quote I'll share here is, old age is a difficult concept for a perpetual adolescent. Hemingway
right.
couldn't handle it, and Hunter went out the same way, although more elegantly.
Yeah, I don't know if there's much elegance about it. I talked to the guy who cleaned up the kitchen. I don't think there's any elegance to it. But the that's a good term. That goes back to his image. He was this big, loopy, big brother figure to millions of Americans. This guy who would say anything and do anything and be sort of the trained gonzo monkey. And I don't know how he could have aged into being a distinguished man of letters.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call, and we'll go to Duluth, Minnesota, and hear from Van next. Van, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My favorite book by Hunter Thompson was Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, and just as an anecdote, that there was a situation where former presidents Ford, Carter, and Nixon were at the same meeting, and Bob Dole remarked, "There goes, hear no evil, hear no evil, fear no evil, and evil." I wondered if the author had heard of that. And also, we're absolutely certain that this was suicide, because, I mean, I'm not trying to be paranoid, but in America, there's been a lot of assassinations and a lot of political murders, and a guy who kept talking about killing himself would be a pretty easy target to a pigeonhole a suicide upon.
First of all, I hadn't heard that, the evil quote, but that's hilarious. Second, I really don't think it was a murder. I think it was what we all thought it was, a suicide, because his son was there. His son found the body. He heard this thing that he thought was somebody dropping a book on the floor, and he found his father in the kitchen. I'm as into conspiracy theories as the next man, but I think that this is a pretty straight suicide.
Van, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. What is your favorite Hunter Thompson story?
Oh, geez, I don't know. You mean the stories that he's written? Because
well, your favorite story?
And that's better than Sex. I think all of his other books have a lot of great moments. But you know, anecdotes about him.
Yeah, your favorite story about Hunter Thompson.
I love that one I told before from Senator McGovern. Like, well, what is it? Don't you want to see what these people are having? I mean, he was just. This outrageous, larger-than-life character, and they're just, you know, what I like about him are the stories you hear of great kindnesses that he did. They're not funny, but you know, when somebody was in trouble, you know, even though Hunter never had much money, even though he's famous, he was never rich. He didn't have a lot of money, but if somebody was in need, he'd help them out. You know, there's so many great stories about him being outrageous and over the top and cartoonish, but to hear that when a friend was in need that he did something to help. I kind of like those stories. As far as the crazy stories, I just love that one because it's part of the way that Senator McGovern, you know, tells the story, and that is just such a, if everyone remembers, I hope Senator McGovern, how great and calm and easygoing he is as a storyteller, and to have him tell this and then laugh, I don't know. I like that story a lot.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Hunter S. Thompson will be remembered most for?
I put that question to a lot of people when I was doing my book, and Tom Wolfe was the one who said closest to what I think will be the case, and that he will be regarded as kind of the American Mark Twain of that end of the century. Because I had always made that comparison. I wrote an earlier book on Hunter when he was alive that came out in 1991, and I had made that comparison to Hunter as being a very much of a Mark Twain kind of writer, writing about culture, but also the way that Mark Twain would use the Huckleberry Finn Jim dynamic as this back-and-forth way of telling a story. Well, Hunter did the same thing with whether it's Dr. Gonzo, Oscar Acosta, whether it's his artist collaborator Ralph Steadman. When he didn't have a companion to use as this literary device in the story, he would invent one. And it said a lot about camaraderie, about human relationships and things like that. And I think kind of his unusual and somewhat twisted view of the world is kind of akin to Mark Twain. A lot of people think of Mark Twain as this genial, white-haired humorist, but he was a significant social critic. And I'm not saying that Hunter Thompson's work will necessarily be remembered with the reverence that Mark Twain's is remembered, but I think he's that kind of character, and I think that could happen.
Mm-hmm. If you had to, if you had to sum up Hunter S. Thompson's life in one sentence, could you do it?
Boy, I don't know. That's a tough one.
That's why I saved it for last.
I think the theme that I saw throughout his life was that he had all of this talent, and he wanted to see what he could get away with. From the time he was a child, he wanted to see what he could get away with as a juvenile delinquent, as a prankster. And I think as a writer, you know, when he found out that great moment he had when he turned in his yellow legal pad and they published it verbatim, and he thought, well, why should I try to write like I'm writing for the New York Times or Wall Street Journal if they're going to publish my notes. And so I think the theme of his life was that seeing what he get away with, and he got away with a lot because he had enormous talent. But I think what really bedeviled him near the end of his life, not just the physical infirmity, what really bedeviled him was the fact that, boy, he could have been a lot better if he had really tried. And he often said that Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was the last thing that he ever rewrote. Everything else that was published after that, he said, was a first draft.
Wow.
And so imagine if he had worked on it, if he crafted a little bit more, how good it would have been.
Unbelievable. Thank you so much for a very enjoyable hour, Professor. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
William McKean, professor and chair of the journalism department at Boston University, author of a number of books, including Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson. Chrissy Pease produced this hour of programming. Katie Mattson handled on-air production. Join me tomorrow morning at 9. We'll talk about fracking, that controversial extraction method for oil and natural gas. And then after 10, the wonders of the universe. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.